Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. I trust you have had an interesting, a fascinating, an intellectually stimulating, but I think perhaps a little bit of rather a sad week in some ways. Rather a sad week, what with what has happened, and that's what we're going to look at today. This is the Anne Widdecombe Memorial Edition of The Jolly Heretic. As you know, I met Anne Widdecombe in January 2022. She was a lovely lady, a very intelligent lady, very fun, very good sport. And Lipton, as you know, is devastated. So we're going to talk about that. So cheers, everybody. Cheers, Adam. Cheers, Lipton. Cheers, Fika Cheats or Paul Taylor. Hergen Gerligan,
Scrubianan,
Saludo, Proust, Prost,
Lachaim,
Skoll,
Yakidar,
Tevesexi, Slanger, and Slangervar, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We are, of course, online public house. Meets on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time. Slanger, Lord Quebec, and 2 p.m. New York, which discuss based science, stuff in the news, and stuff that is increasingly expunged from our woke joke universities, and second time indeed, resident poet. And we have a very special guest for you today, a returning guest. I did a formal kind of interview thing with him a few years ago, and now he's back on the panel, and that is Dr. Adam Perkins, who is a personality researcher who is well known for his brilliant book, what's it called, Adam, your book?
The Welfare Trait.
The Welfare Trait, how
state benefits affect personality.
That's it, chaps. So you should all go and buy that. As you know, I cite it in almost every book I write. So cheers, Adam. And Adam used to be at King's College London, and now he sort of helps out there occasionally. But his book is about 10 years ago, wasn't it? About 10 or 11 years ago, that book?
10 years ago, yeah, that's right.
Okay, 10 years ago. So there's a review of, I wrote of it somewhere, you'll find in some academic journal, and then go out there and buy that. Or if you're Lipton, go to a website and just steal a PDF.
If anyone wants it, I can send the ebook if you want. If anyone wants it, just I've got the PDF for you.
I don't know how happy Paul Grave McMillan would be about that, would they?
They don't mind.
They don't mind. Okay. Well, evening, Adam, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. Okay, chaps. So, serious for a minute. Serious. On Thursday night, a friend of mine in a WhatsApp chat that I'm on messaged to say that he had heard from a friend of Anne Widdecombe's that she had died. And I was terribly upset. I obviously didn't think it was my place to announce it or anything like that, but I did tell Lipton and Paul. And Lipton telephoned me almost immediately to insist that it wasn't true and it hadn't happened and it couldn't be true. And of course, then I told some people about it, and they were like, they were like, no, you're joking. And the next day, it was announced. And it, as of course we all know, this is now the new center of polarization and of general insanity in the UK. And it's a developing story. And I personally have been very shocked by it. It was very sad. I spoke to her in January 2022, and she was such good fun. She was such a laugh, you know. She was just great. She was great fun, and now she has been. It seems I couldn't believe it when I discovered that I couldn't quite believe it. Why would you kill someone like that? And then I've been amazed by the police response. The first of which was to say this is not political, and we have no evidence this is terrorism. Despite the fact that the terrorist police, or whatever they call them, the terrorist unit, were involved in arresting the suspect. So it seems to be quite, I don't know where to start. It seems to be quite amazing how badly this has gone. And I've had arguments on Twitter with people where I've said, look, it says in the paper, it says in the Telegraph, look, it is a terrorist issue. And then we go, oh yeah, the Telegraph, it's just a rag. Like total denial on the part of the left. You've had leftist people like Dan Hodges absolutely insisting that this is nothing to do with terrorism, it's not political, and insisting as well that the family object to Nigel Farage, who was her friend and who she really liked, laying some flowers, and that he's taking advantage. It just is it's the new polarization thing. And I've been amazed by how extreme it is. Adam, what were your first thoughts?
I was, of course, sad to hear a defenseless old lady had been murdered. I mean, if think about the actual situation of someone in their own home, completely defenseless, and getting killed seemingly by someone. And secondly, I was shocked by the reaction of the Be Kind leftists on Twitter and Blue Sky and places like that, where people were celebrating that a defenseless old lady had been murdered. I mean, that shows, if anything, the truth of Roger Scruton's point that whereas right-wingers think left-wingers are merely mistaken, left-wingers think right-wingers are evil and deserve to die, which is just a sad state of affairs.
It's there was a woman who is a computer programming something or other at the University of a trans woman called Heather Herbert, who said that she hoped that she died in agony on Blue Sky, you know, the Be Kind social media. She hoped she died in agony, and moreover that she was manacled to the bed when she died, and refused to back, even then when told she was murdered, refused to back down on this because she's just such an evil person. And it wasn't even true that this rumour was started. The Mirror had to publish an apology this morning for stating that she favoured the manacling of pregnant prisoners, whereas all that happened was she, as the Minister of State for Prisons in 1995 or whatever, inherited a policy where that was done sometimes and opposed it. So there's just no... Yeah, I think you're right about that. Roger Scruton's point that they are... It's there's a nastiness to, I suppose, not all of them. There could be some nice ones, but in general, Anne was friendly apparently with a number of Labour type people. Estelle Morris, I think, was a member of Parliament who she was friendly with. But a lot of it's just so. How can you be? It's not even Margaret Thatcher who did.
Yeah, I think the key point is there's a qualitative difference between left and right. They're not just different ends of a spectrum like a ruler. But there's qualitative difference in the attitude of the sort of more right-leaning people tend to be reality-based, trying to make sense of the world in terms of facts, whereas the left are much more about remaining popular and not getting ostracized. So they will advocate anything that they think will make them acceptable to the cool kids, such as... gloating about the death of a defenseless old lady.
Do you think, in terms of your research on personality, that as the society has become a left-wing society rather than a conservative society, that has flipped? You used to have, for example, I read a biography of Cyril Smith that said that people wouldn't serve him in shops because he was illegitimate when he was a child. And they were concerned, okay, he was a horrible person, but the point is when he was a child, and that they were almost like concerned they'd be polluted by the stain on his very self because he was illegitimate. Do you think that it's inherent in left and right, or is it something that where it's dominant, it's people become uber?
Well, the way I see it is that being a leftist is just a proxy for being socially needy. So needing the approval of other people, irrespective of the truth. So if it became socially acceptable to say that biological men are actually women, people will say that even when it's obviously not true. So they're trying to stay popular and not get ostracized, which you can trace that back to an evolutionary scenario where if you imagine us 50,000 years ago, we would be just living in small, vulnerable communities where sticking together mattered more than anything else. If one of us got ostracized from that group for expressing an opinion the rest of them didn't like, that person would be picked off by a pack of wolves or some other predator very quickly. Whereas if you stay in a group of 20 or 30 people in a hunter-gatherer scenario, you can pretty much defend yourself against any predator by using primitive weapons. So it's almost like leftists are still running that software in their brains, where not being ostracized is paramount. And all sorts of stuff is thrown under the bus in order to just avoid this ostracism, and endorsing all sorts of inconsistent, cognitively dissonant ideas just to try and stay popular.
Right. Okay. Well, let's come back to that. I'll move on to Dr. Paul Taylor. Paul, your thoughts on the Whitcomb thing, first of all.
It's the general climate. We've been going on about it for weeks. The lack of tolerance of genuine debate, the idea that if anyone disagrees with you, they're automatically evil. I detest the double standards when Kemi Badenoch singled out the front bench of Labour and said they were spiteful. Pearls were clutched. Yeah, Angela Rayner can call Tories scum. And that sets the tone of political debate. I remember the good old days with people like Tony Benn. I disagreed with nearly everything he said, but politics were different. Someone like Tony Benn was a lifelong anti-EU person, and politics had reasoned differences on both sides of the chamber, and people listened to arguments, and that's what worries and disturbs me the most. Argumentation is not being listened to. Silos are trenchant. And it's just getting worse and worse. I don't see any upside. As for the police, I'm surprised that you're surprised, Ed. The first time I read anything, it's really, really sad. You know, the BBC used to be a beacon many years ago, it's true, but a beacon of as far as you could get to the objective truth. And now, the first time I read a report from the BBC, I'm wondering what the agenda is.
I just think, Paul, that with regard to the police, they've had so much negative feedback over the last couple of years with regard to two-tier policing, with regard to being biased, with regard to all incompetent as well. And so it strikes me that, OK, now you've got a chance in the wake of Henry Novak, in the wake of the rioting in 2024, in the wake of all of these things where you've been strongly criticised, and rightly so, particularly Henry Novak, you've got a chance now to not balls it up.
Well, why would you? That implies that there's a logical structure that genuine, significant, authoritative senior police officers are in charge. When, as everyone's seen from the College of Policing and the general, Adam will know this and you know this from university environments, the technocracy, the general climate, you could add it to what Adam was saying about groups developing the sense of collectivity. This bureaucratic blindness is in the absolute paws of the police service now. And I don't see how every time Henry Novak, everyone says, well, this can't happen again. That's what they said after the Southport killings. Why does it keep happening if it can't happen again? It's just an empirical, obvious question.
Well, fair enough. Lipton, before we move on to Adam, do you want to say something about Dear Anne, who you love?
Yes. So I wrote two obituaries for Anne Whitcomb. I sent one to American Greatness and I sent one to another publication. It's interesting that Adam Perkins today is a guest on the show, because I have his book online. As you said, I got his book online, and I would really like to know more about the personality of the unaccomplished man who eventually becomes a murderer. I don't want that to become a growing trend. So Charlie Kirk was killed by some loser, and apparently Anne Whitcomb was also killed by a loner suffering from intellectual disabilities, who was basically a recluse, was not quite productive in society. So I'm wondering if these people are committing murders to make themselves purposeful. I'm not sure. I don't know what is your objective.
Yeah, there's quite a history of this sort of thing. Perhaps the most famous example is John Hinckley Jr., who attempted to assassinate Ronald Reagan in 1981. And he came from a really wealthy family. His family owned an oil company. And he grew up in a highly affluent and privileged household, and for whatever reason was unable to achieve, and became fixated upon the famous actress Jodie Foster, essentially stalking her. And in an attempt to get her attention, he decided he was going to assassinate a president. And if I remember correctly, he started off by stalking Jimmy Carter, but he didn't manage to get near him. So when Ronald Reagan was elected president, he switched targets and managed. Well, he came very, very close to killing Reagan. He fired a rimfire revolver, 22 rimfire revolver, so a very low, small, low-powered pistol. But he loaded it with explosive ammunition. So it was a tiny cartridge, but it had an explosive head. And he ambushed Reagan in, I think, the Hilton Hotel driveway or somewhere like that in Washington. And he fired 6 shots, and several of them hit security personnel. And one of the shots hit the frame of the limousine door as Reagan was getting in. And the tiny bullet disintegrated, and a very tiny fragment about the size of a fingernail clipping penetrated under Reagan's arm, and it was so small he didn't even realize what it was. And they closed the door and started driving away from the scene. But one of the Secret Service agents was a very perceptive man, and he detected something was wrong with Reagan. He just had a sixth sense, so he immediately drove to hospital. And it turned out this tiny little fragment of lead had gone in into his lung and penetrated his lung, and his lungs were filling with blood, and he was very close to dying, and he was rushed into emergency surgery. And that's, I think, when he made that famous quip to the surgeons, "I hope none of you are Democrats," or something like that.
That would be relevant now, not then.
Yeah, he did. The surgeons, whether or not they were Democrats or Republicans, the surgeons did a great job, and they saved his life. And Hinckley was obviously arrested on the spot, having been, I think he was detained by some union bosses who happened to be in the vicinity of the shooting. And he was, of course, assessed psychiatrically. And he was, I think, if I remember correctly, he was found to be above average IQ. But they tested him on the Minnesota multi-phase personality inventory, which was a sort of American clinical personality instrument that is still used, I think, but was popular then. And his personality profile came out as highly abnormal. So the key point here is that personality is the boss of IQ. Okay, so you could have an identical twin who's just as intelligent as you are, but if they had an evil, sadistic personality, they might not be spending their life trying to understand science and make humanity better. They might instead become a criminal mastermind or an assassin, such as John Hinckley Jr., although he didn't actually kill Reagan, but he came very, very close. If it wasn't for the sharpness of that one security personnel noticing Reagan was a little bit off color, Reagan would have died in minutes.
That's extraordinary. So we don't know, and we are speculating. And of course, the police have said, "Don't speculate." We can move on to that in a minute. But it's perfect because it does seem really bizarre. It's bizarre behavior from what we know. And I don't know if Paul and Lipton want to come in on this. He apparently drove. Now, Paul and Lipton don't drive, but I can drive. I drive a motor car.
I drive as well. Yeah.
Yes, like all normal men, like men that have testosterone.
What about men who are driven, Ed, hither and thither, as is my birthright?
I see. Yes, it's sort of.
I'm just a bit old fashioned that way.
Policeman mother, essentially, but perhaps that's the case. Yes, perhaps the truly dominant man doesn't
spousal chauffeur, as I always
spousal
phrase
chauffeur,
it.
Exactly. You know, when you married her, will you honor and obey him? And will you drive him about, because he can't be bothered to learn to drive like everybody else? But it does seem that the whole thing is extraordinary. It's an extraordinary behavior pattern, if they're right, which is that he managed to get for 270 miles in about 4 hours, kill her. Now, let's assume she was quite blasé and laissez-faire and it was a hot day and she had all the windows and doors open or something like that. Let's assume that's the case, which is unwise, but look, that's... it's.
That area of the country, I grew up a mile away from that. I grew up in that part of Dartmoor, in Manaton, which is extremely close to Hayes Hall. I could see that from my window in my house. And it's a very, very sleepy area. People leave back doors unlocked and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure. It's a bit like Finland then. It sounds like Finland. So he locks out. Her door's open. He gets in. He beats her to death with what seems like some sort of baseball bat. Appalling. I mean, absolutely appalling. This woman was about 5 foot tall. She didn't stand a chance, really. Gets straight in the car, it seems, and drives back to Rotherham. It's weird behaviour. It's odd. It's peculiar behaviour that I guess would be consistent with a really weird motive, but we can't possibly...
Well, hypothetically, someone who's got an abnormal personality can be capable of bizarre behaviour, even if they may be reasonably intelligent, such as John Hinckley Jr. Or, I mean, perhaps the even more famous example of a famous person being attacked by a mad assassin would be John Lennon, you know, the terrible murder by Mark Chapman. In the foyer of the Dakota Building in New York, you know. And from what I understand, Chapman had been hanging around in front of that building, and he got an autograph from Lennon when Lennon was on his way out to the recording studio, and then waited. And then when Lennon came back in the evening from a recording session, he was still there. And when Lennon got out of the limousine, he shot him. And I don't know. Has Mark Chapman ever given a true account of why he did it?
I don't know. It's your area, not mine, Adam. I don't know enough about it.
From what I recall, there was some vague statement about how because he'd lived in Hawaii at some point, and he found a picture book of the Beatles in the library, and there was a picture of John Lennon, you know, in his nice house or whatever. And he just felt a growing resentment that this man was successful and had all this attention, and he, Mark Chapman, had nothing. So he had some sort of urge to take Lennon down just out of sheer spite.
Appalling. So the next issue let's go on to then.
Sorry to interrupt. Before we move on, did you say earlier that Cyril Smith was? They refused to serve him in certain shops.
Yes, when he was a child.
But obviously not the pie shop.
Apparently, there was, according to the book, which is by a guy that was subsequently the MP for Rotherham, or was it Rochdale? Is it Rotherham or Rochdale? It's Rochdale. That was subsequently the MP for Rochdale. He got some Polish surname. And he wrote the book, Paul Dwagowitz or something like this. And there was some sort of rugby accident when he was at school, when he was about 12 or 13. And it seems to have caused brain damage. And this led to him eating and eating and eating and eating. But before that happened, he wasn't fat. So you know, they just refused to serve him in various... Yeah, it's a very interesting light. It's obviously a horrible guy, but it was a very... It's a bizarre. If you read that book, I forget what it's called. Google it. Cyril Smith biography. It's extraordinary. The things like parents in Rochdale would say, "If you don't behave, I will get Cyril, who's on the town council, to come around and beat you." And then that would happen. And he'd come around and like pull their pants down and spank them. And then it was like, if you were in Rochdale, behave, or I'll get Uncle Cyril on you. There's like loads of testimonies to this. I don't think it's made up. And also it's boys, so they're less likely to make up such things. So like borderline girls making shit up. So it's quite amazing, really. And of course, then he got involved in, you know, like Thomas Hamilton, boys' brigades, all this sort of thing, and just got his jollies and throughout his political career. And when it was looking like there was going to be a coalition government in the 70s, because of the collapse of the Labour Party and the thinking that they'd have to have a coalition with the Liberals. Then, of course, MI5 or whatever went through and found out all these problems with this guy because he was one of the few Liberal MPs and basically said, look, we can't have this guy as a government minister. It's not possible. But it never came to that, fortunately. Yeah, he was a really nasty man. But yet when I was a kid, he was on Spitting Image and he was a laugh and he was great, you know, just like Jimmy Savile, just like Rolf Harris. It's amazing how they hide in plain sight, as it were. Take the risks and they get away with it. I don't know if you've ever thought on this, Adam, as a psychologist.
Well, again, like I said before, personality is the boss of IQ. So these individuals most likely were fairly intelligent. I mean, I've never seen an IQ test of some celebrity like Rolf Harris or Jimmy Savile or anyone else. But I would imagine they're fairly intelligent if you tested them. But once again, they've got these sadistic personalities, which makes them use their intelligence to come up with ways of acting out those sadistic urges. And the smarter they are, the more dangerous they are. So it's a kind of inversion of the usual outcomes of high IQ. Normally, if you average across a million people, the smarter you are, the less criminal you are. Mm. But obviously that's averaging over all personality traits. But if you happen to pick one individual with a highly sadistic personality, such as Jimmy Savile or whoever like that, then they are very cunning at using their superior intelligence to come up with these organized structures to bring victims to them. In the case of being a children's TV presenter, for example, or some sort of some job like that. Rolf Harris's catchphrase was, I think it was, "Can you tell what it is yet?"
Yeah, I hear that Sooty is an absolute pervert. Like, it's just a sick, sick little bear.
But Sweep wasn't.
But Sweep, that's why Sweep and Sue were like, they were,
yeah, they were quite cute.
They were quite cute, but they were so scared of Sooty that they would cover for him. And it was a very, very difficult situation for Matthew Corbett. Lipton, do you have any comments before we move on to something else?
Yes, yeah, so Anne Widdecombe was a woman of deep conviction and sincere principles. That's why she was disliked by the left. Anne had traditional views on marriage, women in the church, and welfare, and she was unwavering in her dedication to her beliefs. And somebody like that cannot be managed by the left. Furthermore, I slightly disagree with those who espouse the view that people on the left deserve our respect. Leftists, they think that people on the right are their enemies, and we should think that they are our enemies too. We should not do PR for them. We should not be afraid to fight them with lawfare, as Paul suggested. And I don't care for people on the left. I don't even want them as friends.
Okay.
Well, no, but come on, Lipton. That's just as bad as left-wingers being completely irrational and not talking to anyone who reads The Telegraph.
Exactly. That's how we should treat them.
No, they're don't.
No, but
so you're the mirror image of something that's wrong.
Yeah, they're lunatics. That's how they treat.
So you'll match that lunacy with a bit of lunacy of your own.
These purity signalers are as bad, I think, as the virtue signalers of the left. They're the right wing equivalent of the left. That's my view.
The thing is, we can't really just get trapped in this sort of demonizing people, because, like Roger Scruton said, we believe left wingers are merely mistaken. You know, they're just normal people who've just got mistaken about something, and so that can happen to anybody. It's a far more morally admirable stance to be like Roger Scruton than to be like one of these leftists who is gloating about a poor, defenseless elderly lady being murdered.
But then, taking Lipton's side, that's why we lose.
Exactly, no, my point.
We lose
because the right isn't any one thing. The right is just a bunch of disparate people who happen to be grounded in reality. So we're different in every other way. We're the only unifying factor we have on the right is that we try to face up to reality, even if reality is not as wholesome as we might like it to be. Whereas the left are, like I said before, they're kind of welded together by this desperate social neediness, this frantic panic to avoid ostracism. And to
I think that's true of the very far right, though. The far right are a bit like that.
Yeah, by right, I just mean sort of fairly average people who just accept reality about biology, about economics, about migration. The famous example would be Elon Musk himself, you know, frequently documented how he started out as this sort of fairly wishy-washy, middle-of-the-road liberal. And he's stayed in that position. And then the rest of the world has shifted. You know, Colin Wright's cartoon. You remember that cartoon where over time the rest of the world has shifted so that someone who previously was just sort of wishy-washy liberal who believed in women's rights and stuff, like J.K. Rowling, for example, as well. She was, again, historically quite a left-leaning person, but she's refused to give in to the bullies of the left.
I remember writing an article in the student newspaper in Durham University in 2001 or something, where I referred to myself as open-minded and a liberal. And that's what I regarded myself as.
Yeah, you haven't changed.
I haven't changed.
That's right. So whilst the far right may be full of headbangers and extremely unbalanced people, they're not what the media now means by right wing. The media now means right wing is someone like J.K. Rowling, who by any reasonable analysis is an old fashioned liberal.
Yeah, and I don't like her. I'm not a fan of her books. I had to read one of them to write.
I've never read a Harry Potter, but I kind of admire her as standing up for truth.
Have you read C.S. Lewis?
Yeah, I used to love C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, me too.
Aslan.
And Roald Dahl. It's better.
Yeah.
This weird tension that she has where, she fetishizes public school and creates a public school that. Literally a public school that witches and wizards go to, but yet on the other hand they do all left-wing shit. I once watched it being filmed in Durham Cathedral. Back to the issue at hand. Now, one of the things that this PC plod, PC deputy assistant, whatever his name is, bloke of Devon and Cornwall police said is that you shouldn't speculate because it is unhelpful. It doesn't help our investigation. And is upsetting to Anne Widdecombe's family. And I found this particularly annoying because what is, if you're not giving us any information, which you're basically not, and you're saying things that are obvious nonsense, such as that this is not political, it's not political, and it's at this stage, we don't believe it to be to do with terrorism and all this stuff, then of course, and it's a very famous person that everyone's heard of, then, of course, you are going to advance hypotheses based on the available evidence to work out what's happening, i.e. speculate. Of course, you will speculate. Why do they say these things, Adam? What do they expect to gain?
Well, I wouldn't know for sure. Maybe they're just trying to control the narrative to make sure it conforms to the metro leftist ideals of the establishment. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that it's emotionally manipulative. It's this idea that if you discuss this, if you think about it, if you discuss it with other people, which you'll find on Facebook more than Twitter, that there's like local people in Rotherham discussing all kinds of things that I shan't repeat on here, in case it's illegal. But people are. What do you think about this, Paul? Do they always do it? They didn't used to do it. Must we not speculate?
But again, I'm sorry to repeat myself, but it's like this technocratic mind virus. They have one agenda and they don't see. This is why I disagree with Lipton about hating certain people. I think you just vehemently point out the inconsistency of their arguments. So for a police chief who stood by and watched them throw statues in the bay in Bristol over the death of a black man on the other side of the world, and somehow that's not speculating about the nature of his death or the significance to a country that has, you know, nothing to do with it. The police pick their battles in a completely partial way and then expect people to listen to them when they try and instruct the population on the basis of policing by consent. That horse has bolted. I've said week after week, people have lost their faith in the police, and this is just another example of that.
Well, what they do, what I saw on Twitter today was that even this is polarised between those who have lost their faith in the police, like me and you and anyone that really thinks about what's happened over the last 30 years, and those who socially signal the extent of their faith in the police. And who argue in various complicated ways that the police are doing a very difficult job and we should try and help them, we should do what they say, and if you don't do what they say, you could bring down the court case, and so they have to be very careful and all this. So there's actually people that are making a great deal of in-group capital out of clearly and directly expressing their faith in the police, even when the police contradict themselves. And go overnight from saying, oh, this is nothing to do with terrorism, it's nothing to do with politics, to it is being now investigated as a terrorist incident. As Adam says, that the controlling of the narrative, it's just about control. This bad thing has happened, we're not in control of it, so let's say we have no evidence it's political, we have no evidence it's terrorist, which is insane. And then you get people grabbing on that and saying, well, it definitely is just a burglary that's gone wrong, that the man came from Rotherham because he just thought I'll burgle somewhere in Devon, and by accident it was Anne Widdicombe's house and he accidentally killed her and then he buggered off. I mean, that's literally what people have been trying to say on Twitter over the last couple of days, which is insane. So they are, it's Emperor's New Clothes territory. It's espousing insanity.
Yeah, the thing is, just because some prominent political figure has been attacked, it doesn't mean the motivation for the attack is political, as we saw with the John Hinckley attack on President Reagan. There was no political element to that. He just wanted to try and get the attention of a famous actress.
Okay, so that's true. It could be that, but that wasn't a possibility they were espousing. They were just saying it was an accident or burglary gone wrong. But no, that is true. And in a way, it would be almost worse, I think, because then it's almost like she'd have died in vain. If she's died as a martyr for her beliefs, which she strongly espoused and stuck to and whatever, that's almost better than the horrible idea that someone was obsessed with a God knows who, some random celebrity.
Well, just wanting to be famous, or just some general motivation that just led them to pick. She's a very famous person, but she's physically more vulnerable than some 6'6" famous male bodybuilder or something, you know. So it's an easy target, isn't it?
Tyson Fury would fight back.
Defenseless elderly lady. I mean, she's got no chance.
No, that would make it really horrible, I think, what you notice with John Hinckley, if that's what's happened. It's like nothing to do with her. It's just, who shall I kill? Oh, we know where she lives. She lives in this village. It's been on telly a few weeks ago, apparently, on a TV program called Celebrity Yorkshire Auction on the television channel Quest. And if you're sitting in the house all day with nothing to do because you're unemployed, presumably you watch a lot of telly, and you see this, and you can work out where she lives. And I mean, she's even got, if you once you found it, it even says on a sign outside it, Widdicombe's Rest. That's the name of her house.
Yeah. There's a certain trustingness to these celebrities, and this was apparent in the. Have you ever visited the Dakota Building, where John Lennon used to live? It's the west side of Central Park. And it's actually got a big courtyard. So the limousines of the residents could just drive straight in and be safe, you know. But he viewed himself as a working class hero, and he enjoyed mingling with fans. So he would, apparently, he would order the limousine to stop in the street and then get out and chat to fans before then walking inside the Dakota Building. And that apparently is what was exploited by the assassin. Because if the limousine had driven straight into the portico through the past the security guards, then John Mark Chapman couldn't have attacked Lennon. So there's a sort of trustingness in these certain celebrities, such as you've said, Ann Widdicombe having her name on the sign of the renaming her house with her own name.
Yeah, in Finland, the post boxes are on the outs. They don't bother to come up your garden path, so you have a series of post boxes in the street which are unlocked, so anybody could just steal your mail for a start. And they have your name on them. And so anybody could, if you wanted to, find out where someone lives. It's such a high trust society. It wouldn't occur to people. Most people around here don't lock their doors where I live. And in somewhere like that, you think you're safe. Rural Devon.
Like I said, I grew up about a mile away, and it is a high trust neighborhood. People don't lock their doors. And they'd leave farmers, for example, would leave eggs for sale at the end of their road with an honesty box sort of thing. Ironically, it was actually when I was growing up, it was a high crime area. There was a spate of burglaries where people would just target these lone houses. Gangs of burglars would target these lone houses. But that was the 80s. And I think crime was higher in the 80s in some senses.
Well, presumably there was less in the way of closed circuit television. There was less DNA evidence. There was all kinds of things that would meant that you could kind of get away with murder in a way.
One night our dog went crazy, absolutely barking, barking mad. And in the morning we found crowbar marks on the back door. This was again in a tiny village in the middle of nowhere. So there was, ironically, back in the old days, there was a lot of crime like this because, like I think you said, there wasn't so much CCTV. People didn't have phones, so they couldn't be tracked. But certainly Ann Widdicombe having the name of her house, having her personal name as the name of her house, would again signify a high trust attitude.
Sorry, someone sent me to... with regard to future releases, Hong Kong, Luton and Slough, you can get a free Jolly Heretic thing if you use the code TJH30, I'm being told to say. So there you go. And go and watch that. And go and watch my documentary on Moldova and Transnistria, which is the places where I'm wondering whether we will move to in the, you know, in the collapse of the society and whatever. Well, we'll move on to that in the next. Naming a house is so cringe, says Tommy. Well, no, Tommy. Naming like a tenement house in Glasgow is a bit cringe, isn't it? Or naming a semi-detached house.
Aren't they always called something like Primrose Meadows? And they're like a stark grey, wind-blown, apocalyptic... horrible.
You do see some people that are pretentious enough to give a name to their terraced house. Yeah, you did that. I have seen that, and that's just being silly, isn't it? But I think if you've got a mansion or something, then you know it's in I don't know, some village called I don't know whatever, Kibworth or something. Why not call it Kibworth Hall if that's what it's always been called? But I think just sort of a Borbag Muse is about barn door C22I is saying yes, that would be a good name.
I call my cottage Guinness Grange, which I think is quite appropriate.
That is good. Or Bleak House. That would be a good name for your cottage. What's your house called, Lipton?
My house does not have a name in it at all. My paternal grandfather is from a place in Jamaica, rural Jamaica, St. Anne, and his siblings, they worked at this facility called Shaw. I don't remember the last name of it. That's the closest we have to some family heirloom. Even we didn't own the property though. But no, my house does not have a name.
My great-great-great-grandfather built a house called Stanthorne Hall, and it's called Stanthorne Hall. It's in Stanthorne, in Cheshire. Unpretentious.
There is a double meaning to the name of Ann Widdicombe's house, because the village of Widdicombe is about a mile away, and the that's a famous location due to the song about Uncle Tom Cobley and all, the famous Widdicombe Fair folk song. So that she's sort of using a bit of a double meaning there. She was.
But is that Widdicombe spelt differently?
It's with got an one I? D. It's got one D.
And an I.
Yeah, it's back in the old days, spellings weren't standardized. Mm. So presumably her one of her relatively recent ancestors came from the village of Widdicombe and was named after it.
Presumably it would be sort of 1400, something like that. Yeah, Lord of the Manor of Widdicombe.
Before the spelling was standardised, you know.
That would make sense. Before the spelling was standardised, ancestors probably Lord of the Manor of Widdicombe, took the name Widdicombe. It's a locative surname. It's discussed in that book, The Sun Also Rises, by that Scottish bloke.
Gregory Clark.
Yeah, him. The locative surnames like mine, even now, are overrepresented in high status positions and things. He didn't announce.
Dutton is an eminent name. There are several academics with that last name. There's somebody called Harry Dutton. There's this literature professor with the last name Dutton.
Dutton. You mean Dutton?
Yeah, Dutton.
Yeah, there's
in that case, Ed, are you a savage case of regression to the mean?
I guess I must be. I'm afraid I must be. My great-great-great-grandfather built Stanthorne Hall, and I have a YouTube channel. So
that's tragic, Ed. I think
what do you know about my last name? Is it Scottish?
Matthews. It's just son of Matthew. It's the son of Matthew, isn't it?
I've gone in the opposite direction from a hubcap empire to a nice spread in the countryside. You've headed in exactly the opposite direction.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, expression to the bill. Perkins, that means just son of Perkin, doesn't it?
So it's short for Peterkins.
So son of Peter.
Mm.
Okay, so that's a low status name that's gone up.
Very low status, and I've maintained that low status.
Ed, I've been doing some research on my last name. I don't know much about it. When it comes to perfect, what's the point of this last name? What does it represent?
It's a nominative. It's the son of Matthew, so it's a low status surname at the time of surnames started to become standard hereditary, which was after the Black Death, and so your ancestor at the time of the Black Death presumably was some person of originally low status that in the chaos of the Black Death had moved up. Otherwise, he wouldn't have had surviving offspring, would he? So that's probably what happened. So he was some serf that moved up. Probably during the chaos of the Black Death or something along those lines, moved up in society anyway, because he would have been reasonably middle class probably about in 1400. But
interesting, there's a book on the history of the last name. I think it was written by some American, and it's quite a long book on the Matthews name.
Is it your white ancestor Matthews? Is he Matthews?
No, my white ancestor's last name is not Matthews, no.
Oh, because then that's not relevant, then, is it? Because Matthews could just be the name.
But in colonial times, I think the owner of a plantation would give his surname to all the enslaved people, wouldn't they?
Yeah. So it doesn't tell you anything about your ancestors. Whereas the white ancestor, was it your grandfather?
My paternal grandfather, his mother, her last name. That's the white name. Tullock. Tullock.
Tullock. Yeah. That's. That's Scottish, I think.
Scottish, yeah, sounds Scottish.
Tullock, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's Tullock. It's Scots Gaelic for disappearing. your ancestors had ghostly powers. Anyway, look, bollocks to this. We're about halfway through, so those of you, hello. Welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We are, of course, an online public house. We meet on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, in which we discuss based science and psychology and stuff which is increasingly expunged from our woke joke universities. If you are new, would you please subscribe? Would you subscribe on YouTube and hit the like button and hit the bell button and leave a comment for the algorithm and all that stuff? And when you subscribe on my Substack, that's jollyheretic.com, where I put all the most based stuff I dump on YouTube, in-person interviews, blogs, films I make, all kinds of malarkey, and where if you like what I do, you can support me for the cost of a pint of beer a month. And I have to promote a code for you with regard to my new films, and that is TJ H30, and this allows you to watch my new films for free. So go and do that, and also of course buy my books, which are brilliant. I've got a book coming out in August on borderline personality disorder. So you know that will be coming out in August. So you can all look forward to that.
That's your autobiography, Ed.
No, it's the autobiography of every woman you've ever been out with.
Scrub your nan.
But anyway, it's the biography of many women that we've known here on the panel, I think. So go and have a look at that. It's the biography of all women that are active on the far right without exception. That will be coming out soon. And then I've got a book with Mike McCulloch on ancient civilizations, and that will be coming out quite soon as well. And also you should buy this book, which I've had for many years. Look at this, Anne Widdecombe. Strictly Anne, and it's very good, and it's very well written, and I'm pretty sure she would have written it herself rather than be one of those fibbers that gets someone to write their book for them, and it's very good. So Strictly Anne. Speaking of ancestors that we were talking about earlier, her ancestors weren't considered good enough by Who Do You Think You Are? So they started off researching her ancestors for the show, and her ancestors were so boring that there was nothing, so they never actually made the episode. And apparently that happens quite a lot. That happens in about, so for every person that's in Who Do You Think You Are, there's at least one or two where they start researching it and they're like, your ancestors are yeoman farmers in the 17th century. This is boring. It's like everybody else. They're rubbish. So that's what happened to Anne, unfortunately. So she was the most interesting person. She and her family, actually, because her nephew was in the papers in the year 2000 because he was in prison for assault and he was a cocaine addict. And then her other nephew is a priest. So, interesting people. Right, next to me we have Dr. Adam Perkins, who, if you've read my books, you will find his book on state benefits and so forth, The Welfare Trait, cited many, many times, particularly the bit about some study in New Zealand called the Dunedin study or something like that.
Dunedin study.
Can't be buggered to go back to the original source, so I cite his book for that. So go and buy that book. It's a mere £85 on Amazon.
Yeah. The prices have been jacked up for academic books, so don't bother buying it. Just contact me or Ed, and you shall have the ebook.
Gracious. Very well. God, you should. You're Lipton's hero, because Lipton exclusively reads academic
books. That's how I read his book. I downloaded it from some pirate site.
I didn't. I got in touch with Palgrave Macmillan. And they sent me, because they were too pikey to actually send me the physical book, they sent me a PDF of the book to review, which I think is outrageous. I think, like, normally you should send a physical book to review. But no,
yeah,
no.
They didn't even send any books out to journalists for review. So in the end, I bought some copies of my book and I posted them out to various journalists, and actually that worked.
Okay, well, you'd have got author pricing on your book, wouldn't you? £2.50.
Yeah, it used to be. I think originally it was £20 or £18, but
there was a paperback with a sort of a thing that
That was the original paperback version.
That was really cool. Look, put that to the camera. You can see that. So it's an unemployment form that you fill out. That's what they use.
That's the design. I wanted to do my own design, but they wouldn't let me do it. They said, no, we've got professional designers. And so that's what they came up with, which is pretty good.
What were you going to do?
But this was £18 originally, and then now it's gone up to 83 or something. But if you want the want a copy, just get in touch with me or Ed.
Okay, so do that. What was your design going to be, Adam?
I was going to have a bomb lighting its own fuse.
Okay, good. So next we have Mr. Lipton Matthews. You can't see him, but he's there.
Lean forward, Lipton. Lean forward.
He has a number of books that are available.
There we go. Lean forward more.
Lean forward more. He has
lean
a number
forward
of
more, Lipton, because you're not breaking through the background. There.
Bang your head on the camera, Lipton. Go on.
He has a number of books available on Amazon. Most recently, his book, Busting African Delusions. So go and purchase that. And I've reviewed it for somewhere. So go and purchase that. And then finally, we have Dr. Paul Taylor, and his channel is called Readers of the Lost Art, where he takes a how can I put it nicely?
Depressing.
A depressed, unhappy, gothic novel kind of look at things, including gothic novels, but also various things. So please go and subscribe over there. And he has a number of books which are also available on Amazon, such as the Slavoj Žižek study of whatever.
Adam, important point. Paul is really smart. He has a really high IQ. Once we went to Liverpool and Paul gave me £20.
Yes, he did, for saying that. That's correct. And then you didn't give it back because you didn't understand it was a joke for the cameras. Okay, we have a resident poet here at the Jolly Heretic Public House, Mr. Quinn, and he has written the following poem. Hang on, I have to scroll up. There we go. In light of today's discussion, police say they've captured their man who murdered our poor dear old Anne. While she's now in heaven, he drove down to Devon. But was it all part of a plan? Thank you very much, Mr. Quinn.
Mate.
And if you like Mr. Quinn's poetry, then you should buy his book of Jolly Heretic Poetry, which is available on Amazon. And also, you could subscribe to his channel, which is Resident Poet at the Jolly Heretic. That's very good. Thank you very much, Mr. Quinn. Okay, now we have a question from a goth bureaucrat. Thank you, sir. Is Jolly Heretic a dolphin in a bathtub? This is, I believe, a reference to the Harry Enfield sketch that's called Panel Show, where they have the Paul Merton character saying, "Is it a dolphin in a bathtub?" I think I get your reference. Anne Widdecombe, of course, was once or twice the chairman of the Have I Got News for You, which it was a satire of. So, no, the Jolly Heretic is not a dolphin in a bathtub.
Ed, can I do a very rare thing and compliment you? That was very, very impressive trivia knowledge. Well done.
Thank you very much. No, I know my comedy. I know my comedy.
And yet none of it's ever rubbed off on you.
No, it's never, no, that's very good. It's never rubbed off. That would be the kind
You're not a dolphin in a bathtub, Ed. You've just gained a bit of weight recently.
and lost the use of my legs. I did see dolphins, actually. It was great. I don't know if you've seen. I was in the Canary Islands in 2021 with my family, and we went out on a boat. And they're so sociable and nosy. They come up to the boat and then perform tricks for you. Because they're very clever. I think they have the mental age of like a 9-year-old or something like that. And so they're sort of, yeah, wow, brilliant. Look at that. Look, there's humans on a boat. Let's go over and show them some of the jumping we can do.
Ed, you are quite oleaginous and shiny.
Oleaginous.
I'm beginning to see it now.
I don't know. I think it's just the lighting.
And the oil of Ule and the Grecian 2000 and all those things.
Well, no, as I've explained to you, Paul, some of us in our 40s, we maintain our hair and we maintain our hair colour. Nick Griffin is another example. He's 66 years old, and he has a full head of luscious brown hair. It's quite extraordinary. I've no idea what state his chest hair is in, or his pubes. I did ask him, actually, and he said it's a bit of a personal question, it's very, very, very not going the old grey yet. So, yes. All right. So, carrying on then in the Anne Widdecombe edition, we will move on to the issue of Adam Bolton.
Yes.
Now, this interested me because there was an... I understand, you know, in an autistic kind of way, that you're not meant to say certain things when someone's died and you're only meant to say nice things and whatever. But she made a point of saying, I mean, she openly said, yeah, so what? I'm a spinster, I'm toothy, and I'm dumpy. Who cares? That's what she said. She said that. She made it part of her identity that she was a spinster, that she was an old maid. It was kind of her cope. She kind of said, I don't care. I'm happy the way I am. I don't mind. And so I found it a bit much that it was almost like they were just looking for an excuse to have a go at him. I mean, what he was saying, she's openly discussed these things. So I don't know what chaps think about
You're defending Adam Bolton.
I'm defending him. I mean, obviously, he's a ghastly person, and he was just horrible. But I'm just, it's what the reaction was very strong when you consider that she's openly embraced.
Yeah, but there's context. She might have said all sorts, but when you've been killed, maybe he didn't know that, but he knew she died. And this goes to the breakdown of civil discourse. Whether you're left, right, or whatever, the idea that when someone's died, you can't just shut up and not be nasty for five bloody minutes is beyond the pale. And people in the comments were saying, I'm trying to play cricket with people who don't want to play cricket. And I think they're mistaken, because in instances like this, this is one of the few times I think there should be an absolute witch hunt against Adam Bolton. I think he should be sacked, because it's absolute. It's not about politics. It's about human decency, journalistic ethics. He was a friend of Mandelson. He's an absolutely reprehensible human being, and he showed his true colours. And that's when people on the right should pick their fights. That's when they should go after people on the left.
Yes, that's a good point. I must say, I was surprised. I watched it live, and all I remember thinking was, I'm just a bit surprised that he's mentioning these things. Why is he mentioning? He specifically said that she was a virgin.
Well, the other cheap shot is it's linked. I'd argue it's linked to her Catholicism. So she was openly. She said when questioned, "No, I'm not in favour of gay rights because it's part of her Catholic faith." She was obviously anti-abortion, unlike I guess Andy Burnham will prove to be. So she stood by her beliefs. And I've always been fascinated, if Islam was anti-abortion in quite a dogmatic way, it would be fascinated how the media approached that topic. But Catholicism it's an easy low-hanging fruit. And I think she was victimized because of that.
Adam, you're nodding in a sage understanding.
They're scoring cheap points, like Paul says, on a target that won't fight back. They wouldn't be saying the same things about some kind of religion that might turn up on their doorstep and cut their head off.
No, probably not. No, and yeah, this isn't Ireland in the 1950s. You know, you don't have what's his name? What was that guy that was the Archbishop of Dublin with his gang of toughs that would come and beat you up if you criticised the Catholic Church? John Charles McQuaid.
I actually long for a return to those days, Ed, so I'm slightly mixed on that one.
Friend, my Irish friend, I don't know if he's watching, but my Irish friend, you can't get this book outside of Ireland. I tried many years ago to get this book, and it's impossible to buy this book. John Charles McQuaid, the ruler of Catholic Ireland, fascinating guy, de facto ruler of Ireland for about 40 years. And you can't get this book outside of Ireland. And I've now got it. And
was he the inspiration for Bishop Brennan in Father Ted?
Very possibly, yes. He absolutely ran the place. It was behind the scenes, the de facto, you know, the daddy of the country. Very interesting guy. Psychologically, his mother died when he was very young, abusive childhood, and then he moves to basically being in charge of wrote the constitution effectively. So I don't know. I'll go off the topic here, but we've only just done. We've stayed on topic now. Good God! Often, Adam, we go off topic on this.
No, we stayed on topic because I've been silent. I've been silent because I'm angry.
Go on then. Go express. Why are you angry, Lipton?
You know I'm angry because Adam Widdicombe was killed by a useless son of a gun, and I'm angry.
Understandably so. We're all
angry. I really loved Anne Widdicombe.
You did, didn't you? She was great. I like the way that in a society where we've moved from, we don't talk about sex, it's not the thing you talk about, so we just talk about nothing else. and she took the view that such questions were an impertinence. That was the word she used, an impertinence. And when she arranged this thing with Louis Theroux in the whatever it was, 2001, I think it was, that he goes around with her, she specifically said, I don't want to discuss anything to do with my sex life at all. And that was broken. That agreement was broken within 5 minutes.
Well, also, I admired the way that she judged the sin and not the sinner. So she stood by Harvey Proctor in his various legal cases, despite the fact someone into BDSM in the way he was would have been completely antipathetic to all her values. But that didn't faze her. She thought what was right and what was wrong. He was being persecuted by the establishment, and she stood by him, which I really admire.
Yes, well, he's, of course, a bit on the Jolly Heretic, Harley Proctor.
Yeah, he was.
He was, yes, and far, far worse things that then subsequently happened. You know, appalling allegations by a total fantasist that he was a murderer.
Oh, yeah, don't even start me, because James O'Brien is still on LBC, despite having given a platform for that liar, and never seems fazed by the fact he was proved to be an incompetent journalist.
No, but there was this hysteria where this idea that you just believe anybody that says they've been sexually abused or whatever.
Didn't James O'Brien write a book? I think the title was something like How to Always Be Right or something.
Well, so yeah, lie. Yeah. I'm not familiar with that, but it is.
No, I'm pretty sure he did a book. So the lack of self-reflection, having on a public stage been proved to be heraldically wrong, he then writes a book like that. So that's a psychological study all in and of itself.
What do you think of James O'Brien, Adam, within the boundaries of the law?
I'm sorry, I don't know who James O'Brien is.
That's admirable.
If only we could go backwards in time and claim your lack of knowledge.
I wish I could be in that situation, but he is a sort of a left-wing shock disc jockey, essentially. Not disc jockey, but a left-wing, the left-wing, what's that nutter called on the right that goes on like frogs being gay? Him.
Alex Jones.
Yes, almost like the left-wing equivalent of him.
He's a cheerleader for the establishment and the status quo.
Yeah, in a really extreme and aggressive and angry way.
Up the establishment.
Up control and the lack of free speech.
Down with free speech.
Down with free speech. Forget free speech. It's awful.
Right. When I was, I remember when I was a kid, the cutting edge media personalities challenged the establishment. Something's changed.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. So, what's changed?
Don't know.
You still had a kind of vaguely conservative establishment in charge, and then so you challenged that, Mrs. Thatcher.
Yeah, and so the people who now are supposedly edgy comedians, whatever, they're just cheerleading drones for the establishment.
Yeah, they're established, as Nick Dixon puts it, they're establishment comedians, they're regime comedians.
Adam, while you're on, I'm absolutely intrigued by Frankie Boyle, who was one of the most acerbic extreme comedians on the circuit, and he had this weird reverse Damascene moment, and he talk about becoming a shill for the establishment. I found that one of the most bizarre changes of personality I've ever seen.
Yeah, maybe he just needed the money.
Yeah, but having had a track record of being so confrontational and so anti-establishment, and to flip on a dime
Did you ever watch Tramadol Nights?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was something to do with Tramadol Nights, I would suspect. He was given a warning. He was given a warning that if he wanted his career to continue, then no more Tramadol Nights must be broadcast. And I think he got afraid.
I thought his Rebecca Adlington joke was viciously inappropriate, but one of the funniest jokes I'd ever heard.
Yeah. He made horrible comments about Jordan's disabled child or something, didn't he?
That's right, yeah.
You know, just horrible things. But the whole sort of chaotic, anarchic atmosphere of Tramadol Nights, I think, you know, it was original TV, but I think that got him in trouble with the deep state or something, and he got threatened or something like that. I would imagine.
Presumably, comedians and people that are quite sort of mentally unstable and narcissistic anyway. So,
they're more neurotic than average. There was a study comparing the personalities of professional comedians, amateur comedians, and then average people. And there's no personality difference between amateur comedians and average people, but professional comedians were significantly more neurotic. Perhaps due to the...
Why do you have any idea as to why this makes them better comedians?
Well, maybe it's because tragedy is kind of amusing. You know, when people talk about their like Bill Hicks, for example, talking about his sort of inner world, and it's all kind of tragic and chaotic, and people find some sort of amusement in that, people joking at the expense of themselves. Whereas if you're low neurotic, you just see yourself as, you know, a positive person. So there's nothing to really joke about.
Ed, have you seen Anthony Jeselnik on Netflix?
I'm afraid not, no.
No, you need to check him out. I'm guessing it's J-E, either single S or double S-E-L-N-I-K, I'm guessing. Anthony Jeselnik. But he is one of the darkest, funniest. He has a really deadpan delivery. And I think I might have said to you before, after the remember the Chicago bombing at the Chicago Marathon? Yeah. And he, after about 10 seconds, he tweeted immediately, there are some lines you just shouldn't cross. And he really doesn't care about the type of, you know, kickback that he's had. It just adds to the aura around him. I think he's a brilliant comedian.
Well, comedians, yeah. As an intelligent researcher, probably you know this, but comedians tend to be quite intelligent.
Yeah. Yes.
People often say that I'm funny, Ed, but when they say so, I say no. I'm not funny. I am serious.
Yes, because you're not intelligent enough to be funny.
You're as serious as a coffee table, Lipton.
the thing is, there's a difference between wit and humor, right? So wit is just some snarky, quick comment about someone's appearance, whereas humor, it kind of touches the sort of futility of human life and the kind of doom. We've all got feet of clay, right? We're all flawed individuals. And you get that famous example was, I think, Kurt Cobain. He was talking about one of the lyrics in Nevermind when he sings "Somewhere I Have Heard This Before" about a particular tune, right? That's the lyric, "Somewhere I Have Heard This Before." And a journalist said, well, where did you hear it before? What song was it? And he goes, "I don't know, but I bet I'll find out soon enough." You know, implying that someone would try and sue him to get money.
Oh, I see. Yes.
So that's kind of real humor. He's kind of mocking himself in that he's plagiarized a tune, but he can't remember where it's from. But he says, "Don't worry, the money grabbing tendencies of mankind will make sure that I find out soon enough."
Yeah, indeed. But it's interesting that there hasn't been that switch, though, that these people that were very funny and were satirizing the conservative sort of regime of the people that were born in the 1920s and so on, that were running the country in the 80s, Rick Mayall and Adrian Edmondson, and well, not that they've been particularly pro-woke, but Paul Merton, Ian Hislop, these kinds of people. And I find that in some cases there's a change. So in some cases there are those that now see, okay, the power is with the left, so we'll satirize that. So there's some kind of comedians that have done that, but those people have been completely ostracized from the establishment.
Yeah, because the thing is, like we said before, the left think people who disagree with them are evil. So if it's a left-wing TV commissioning editor and you're a comedian satirizing the left wing, he's going to think you're evil. So he's not going to put you on TV. It's you know, that's the way it works. And there's always been a sort of control. Do you remember Richard Pryor, the great American comedian, Richard
yes.
Pryor? And you know, he had sort of two careers, if I remember rightly. He started out as just a conventional, very talented, but conventional comedian doing jokes about the mother-in-law and the traffic jams and stuff. And then he was on stage in somewhere like Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas doing a really big show. And he just suddenly stopped and he said, "What the hell am I doing here?" And he walked off stage and disappeared for a couple of years. And then he reemerged in a small kind of venue somewhere in Greenwich Village or somewhere. And he was completely changed his comedy style. So his comedy style, instead of telling these kind of classic stereotypical jokes about the mother-in-law, he started just telling stories of his childhood growing up in Peoria, where his grandmother ran a brothel, and he grew up in this brothel, and he just started telling stories about, you know, what it was like. And it's kind of touching upon the human frailty from all different communities, not just the white community, not just the black community, but he was talking from a humanist perspective, and that was where the humor came from. And then he kind of carried on like that for a while and was really successful again with this more challenging, intellectually deep comedy. And then he went into Hollywood, and then he started doing stuff like Superman and Stir Crazy, which were more commercial Hollywood movies. But he's a good example of, he started off with the establishment in the 60s, pandering to the TV commissioning editors who just wanted jokes about mother-in-laws and traffic jams. Then he moved into what we now call alternative comedy, where you're satirizing life and typically the establishment. And then he moved into the Hollywood big bucks.
I suppose one way of seeing it is that if your characterization earlier is correct, right v left, right wing people are mentally stable and secure, and so they can cope, they can deal with being satirized. They don't mind being satirized, and particularly if it makes money for the channel, then they don't mind. Whereas left wing
they're not necessarily mentally stable. They're just not so vicious. And they just think, well, you know, people have different opinions. If somebody's a left winger, they're just mistaken. You know, that's just the way it is. They don't have this, he must be destroyed, kind of left wing mindset.
Right. So that's the difference then. Yeah. So the right wing establishment would allow themselves to have the piss taken out of them.
That's what the sort of Monty Python type, that was satirizing the British establishment. And it was actually broadcast by the British establishment. At that time, it was a bit more conservative.
Ed, someone in the comments mentioned Benny Hill. Do you have a view on him?
I like the song Ernie.
It's an existential epic.
It is brilliant. Yeah, it's brilliant.
But I also think he was under, well, trivia points. He's the only comedian who's ever caused a riot in an American prison. I might have mentioned that before. No. It was somewhere like in Alabama. There's a massive state prison, and they were due to watch Benny Hill, and someone had done something. They withdrew television privileges, and the whole prison went on a riot. So that's Benny Hill. But also, he did one skit where he's got this really attractive next-door neighbor in a bikini, and she's putting little mini briefs on the washing line, and they've got Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday on each of them. And then he turns around and he's got a really hideous wife who happens to be a man dressed as a woman. And she's putting up bloomers that say autumn, winter, spring, summer. And it's that type of, I think that is really clever.
Yeah, yeah. Do you remember Dick Emery?
Nope.
Did anyone remember Dick Emery? And he
naughty.
Yeah, and do you remember there was an episode where there was a prison, I think Wandsworth Prison or something. And Dick Emery turns up outside dressed as a lady, a sort of middle-aged lady, and she's volunteering to be a prison visitor. And she knocks on the door, and the prison officer says, "Hello, what do you want?" And she says, "I want to be a prison visitor." And the guy goes, "Oh, I'm sorry, madam. Some of these men haven't seen a woman for 20 years. We couldn't guarantee your safety." And she was like, I'm willing to risk it.
Do you remember when he did an advert for cream cakes because his catchphrase was naughty but nice? And there'd be a cream cake and he'd go, naughty but nice. That was on ITV.
Yeah, he was a genius.
Yeah.
But yeah, Richard Pryor, you can go ahead and talk
about Richard.
Yeah, so Richard Pryor had, you know, he had a lot of mental problems. He talked openly about, you know, his difficulties with drugs and depression and so forth. But that humanity and human vulnerability was what made his comedy so powerful. I think the first joke he did, because he grew up, like I said, he grew up in Peoria and in the black community, and I think he opened his comeback show when he switched from this tired, predictable mainstream comedy to his more challenging comedy. The first joke was something like, he said, I didn't meet a white man until I was 4 years old. When there was a knock on the door, and I opened the door and there was a white man there, and he said, "Hello, little boy. Is your mother home? I want a blowjob." and that was the mayor. So, you know, he just suddenly went into this social commentary that was just brutal and very, very different to the previous kind of sanitized jokes about traffic jams. And he built up this alternative comedy. He did records. You remember he used to do records, LPs. I don't know if you listen to any of those. And then essentially he got cancelled because he wasn't tolerant enough of LGBT people, I think. I don't know the full story.
He was bisexual.
Yeah, he was bisexual himself. And he said things like, you got to be careful with sucking dicks because you can get addicted to it.
Oh God!
But anyway, he's a good example of an honest comedian in that he gave up these traditional jokes about mother-in-laws and traffic jams, and he just started talking honestly about his life, and that's when he became this legendary stand-up in the '70s, basically.
You're not triggered, are you? Because we don't want to talk about how you got your driving license again.
Exactly.
It's a bit close to the bone, so to speak.
Boner. Is Adam aware of Lipton's piano playing skills? Yes, I think he can see the fake piano that he has. Okay.
I write good jokes.
Do you?
Yes, I do.
When have you written a joke, Lipton?
I've been writing jokes for a long time. Let me give an example. Once, okay, there was this little boy who kept walking around in the same space over and over. So an elderly man said to him, "Why are you walking around like a man who's looking for a shadow at a brothel?"
Okay.
So the boy, that's the joke. So the man at the brothel is looking for a woman to have sex with.
The man the what? If I could hear you understand your accent, it would work.
There's a man with a bottle. There's a man with a bottle and there's a little boy.
Not bottle, prostitution host then. Brothel.
Oh, a brothel. Brothel. Yes. Okay. Yes. Right.
Yes. So the man is looking for somebody to sleep with, so he keeps walking repeatedly. And the little boy is following the man's pattern. That's the joke. So men who want to sleep with prostitutes at the whorehouse, they walk around quite a bit to get the right prostitute. So the little boy was walking repeatedly over and over, like a man at the whorehouse was looking for.
Yeah, normally, Lipton, if you have to explain it like this, it hasn't really worked as a joke.
That's why my jokes are good, because I have to explain them. They're logic questions, really. They're not really jokes.
They're not so much jokes then as sort of.
I actually thought Lipton was reading from Waiting for Godot then.
No. It's a logic question. It's not really a joke. But I find them funny.
I haven't seen Waiting for Godot, but I have seen that stupid one where there's a mouth and it goes.
Yeah, oh yeah. That's brilliant. Oh, that is stunningly good.
What? No, you, he. I saw that at the Half Moon Theatre in Islington.
The logistics are amazing. They have to get a scaffolding to get the mouth up really high behind the curtains. And you have to memorize stream of consciousness that gets increasingly quicker.
That is true. Yeah, I didn't think of it from the actor's perspective.
Oh, yeah, it's really, really difficult.
But I didn't like
it. I have written a short story, and I want to share the short story with you.
We're not going to read it out, are you sure?
No, I'm going to email you or send you the short story, and you can publish it online.
Well, I don't know if I like it. I might, you know, look into it. As you, I can't guarantee you, you know, that I will like your short story, Lipton.
Lipton, have you tried to get a contract, you know, for that joke, you know, in Christmas crackers or Chinese cookies or... I think that's a winner.
Sorry, we've got 5 minutes left, chaps, so we've moved off the topic a little bit onto Christmas crackers and Chinese cookies. So I'd like to move back onto Anne Widdecombe, which is the main focus. So we'll just finish off. Adam, what was your favourite thing about Anne Widdecombe?
I just liked her straightforwardness. She didn't put on a show and try and put on a fake act. She just seemed to be unapologetically herself, and I like people who do that.
Yeah, for example, in the late 90s when she started to become famous, and she had this haircut that was, I believe it's known as the Page Boy, where it was basically just a sort of a bowl over her head, and she didn't care. She just didn't care. Subsequently she lost a lot of weight and stuff like this. So I don't know, maybe she did care, but it seemed as though at that cult of youth kind of thing, she just didn't care, and that was very, very. I can see the first time I saw her on telly, and she was a government minister for prisons. I was just like, God, who is this? Bloody hell! And short, overweight, and just didn't care. There was something very likable about that when she was made Shadow Home Secretary. She was a very good speaker. She was a very good public speaker. Very, very funny, spoke without note, very witty. That the kind of candidate that probably wouldn't get selected these days, because it has to go through central office and she'd be considered too eccentric and too weird. And so
She wouldn't be telegenic enough to pass the screening process.
No, she's not like Laura Trott and such like telegenic pretty young things that are now in the shadow cabinet. She wouldn't work. It wouldn't work. Paul, what did you like most about Anne Widdecombe?
The fact that she was unapologetically what she was. So I'm sorry to pick on the Catholicism notion again, but I just think it's very instructive. It's what her faith was, and she wasn't going to say what the cameras wanted her to say. And just to repeat, watch this space. Watch Andy Burnham. When it suits him, he dresses himself up as a Catholic. But the minute he gets asked an awkward question, he'll just jettison any actual, you know, element of his supposed credo at the drop of a hat. And I liked the way she was a Catholic, she stood by it, even though it was kryptonite for the media, and that just reflects she's, you know, she had an iron constitution, and she didn't bend for anyone.
Of course, she was raised as an Anglican, and she went to a Catholic school, to a convent school, which obviously stuck with her. But she kept being an Anglican. Her brother, Malcolm, was an Anglican priest until they ordained women priests. And then in 93, and then she just said, no, this is just not on. This is too much. I say this as the husband of a female priest, but, and that was it. And she became Catholic, and then suddenly was very quickly my RE teacher, Mr. Sutton. He objected to this. He said, "Who is this woman? She's suddenly an expert on Catholicism. She was an Anglican 5 minutes ago. What is this?" But anyway, we can't discuss the nuances of Anne Widdecombe's personality at the current moment. We have to wait. Lipton, you of course loved Anne Widdecombe dearly.
Of course.
You were very, very upset.
Yes, she was eccentric, original, witty. There was nothing wrong with her mannerism or her dressing, especially and Widdecombe aged with grace.
She did. No,
yes, she aged with grace.
I mean, my granny Ivy died aged 79, and she looks a lot older than Anne Widdecombe looks now. Anne Widdecombe's 78, so No, there was just something funny. There was something funny when on Thursday last week when I was told about this. I thought, well, hang on a minute. She was only on like Talk TV or something that I saw her on the other day, and she was fine. And you could say, oh, she was overweight, but she wasn't overweight. She used to be overweight. She's not overweight now. Speculate on Ed.
Someone just said she changed her religion and their politics. No, both the religion that she was a member of and the party she was a member of left her, not the other way around.
Exactly. This is true. She was Anglican until there was a turning point, and that was women priests, and she was just like, no. They changed. Anglicanism changed. The party changed. There you go. All right. Well, I would like to thank Adam for coming on, and remember to steal his book online.
Don't buy my book. Don't buy my book. Just ask me and I'll get you a free copy.
It's very rare that authors say that, but this is, look at the magnanimousness of this man.
Magnanimity.
Even that, but I just thought magnanimous sounded better.
You just made up a compound noun. Are you German?
I reckon magnanimousness is a word. It sounds good. It sounds like a kind of the name of a car, a shiny car.
Sounds like a massive ice cream.
Yeah, all that. Yeah, okay. I'd like a magnanimousness, please. That's £3. £3 for an ice
with a
cream.
Flake, with a bloody big flake.
Flake in it, a big flake in it, a big
and
flake.
Sprinkles.
And sprinkles a lot, and strawberry sauce. Remember the days in about 1990 when that would have cost you 65p, and now it's about £3. But okay, a magnanimousness, and like a magnanimousness, please. We will see you next week, chaps, and tally ho, and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Yeah, bye. Okay,